Why don't we go ahead and get started? I don't know if everybody's still passed out or if Ron Paul's giving a lecture downstairs and competing with me, but let's go ahead and get started. So, again, let me ask, how many people have seen me give this, like, on YouTube or something? Okay, looks like a lot of you. All right, I know I say this every lecture, but I will try to get through the PowerPoint quickly to leave time at the end, because this topic in particular is the one where people are like, you know, what if there's midgets who are attacking me, and you know, and I have a double-edged sword, dragon slaying power. What do I do then? What would the market say? Okay, the market for security. So this, I think this is one of the. I mean, this really isn't about Austrian economics at all, but it is useful because, as you guys have probably determined, or if you didn't know until you came here, that there's a bunch of faculty members who are anarchists. So surprise, you know, And this is, but and it's, at first, that obviously sounds crazy to people, and it just means, well, if you get the logic of privatization, if you understand how somebody could think that schools should be privately run and not run by the government, or even roads and mail delivery and things like that, well, then this takes it to the logical extreme to say even things that at first glance seem like they have to be provided by the government, namely legal rulings, you know, police protection and military defense, that you push the logic and say, well, what about these things? And let me just mention, it came up, I don't know if the person's in here who asked me, but somebody was saying, you know, what have you found in terms of trying to talk to someone about anarcho-capitalism? What's the most effective strategy? And I say, well, first of all, don't use the A word. That's just crazy, because it just has so much baggage with it that that's going to instantly put their defense up. But just say something like, you know, don't even let them know what you're talking about first, and just say, hey, you know, hey, how do you... Do you like monopoly or competition? And they're going to say competition, and then say, well, why? And get them to spell out the reasons as to why, in general, you know, competitively supplied goods and services are better. That's a better framework than monopolized ones. And then, you know, you can sort of back them into a corner and then say, okay, what those reasons you just said, do you think it's more or less important for them to be a competitively supplied good if it's something that's really important to people? Or something that's like a triviality, and presumably they would say, well, the more important it is, the more important the good is, the more important it is that it's provided in the most efficient, fair way that avoids corruption, which is a competitive market, like I just said. And then you sort of, you know, back them in. So you're probably not going to convert someone on the spot if that's what your goal is, but it'll at least cause cognitive dissonance, and they'll have to come up with some reason why, oh, wait a minute, everything I just said the last 8 minutes doesn't apply when it comes to, you know, the police and the military. Okay, let me first just give this disclaimer. So I actually am a pacifist, and so some people, when they know that, when they hear about that, they're saying, well, wait a minute, how can you have an essay out there about private defense, and you're talking about, you know, heat-seeking missiles and things like that? That's crazy. And it's not really crazy at all that, like, I could get up here and give a lecture on drug legalization, and I hope you wouldn't be shocked to learn that I don't use heroin. Right? Some of you are shocked to learn that I don't use heroin, but that's a separate thing. So it's the same thing with this, that, you know, as an economist, in a few minutes, I'm going to tell you about the market for private military services and how I think that market would behave if we had a society with people that were like, you know, modern-day Americans or Europeans or, you know, what we think of as Western countries right now, if it had people like that with those value systems and the things they cared about and their views on violence and when it's okay to use force against somebody, those kind of people that were the consumers in this market, and then I can talk about what would happen if the government got out of the way and didn't use its own power to prohibit people from offering competitive defense services, just like I can talk about with the people right now. I know there are plenty of people that would patronize people who sold heroin and cocaine and marijuana and things like that if the government got out of the way and just let those markets unfold naturally. And so that's my position here is that I personally would not pay someone to go, you know, use a tank to go do something to it, you know, to achieve something I wanted. I don't think that's the right means to an end, but that's a personal value judgment, and that's distinct from me as an economist saying what I think would happen in our world if governments got out of the way. But having said all that, let me just take a few moments. So this is new. This is something I'm talking about this year, not last year. Because things are getting pretty crazy in the political scene and you know, in the United States, and I think if you're from another country, in your country probably as well, that there are a lot of libertarians who are, you know, thinking we got to stop just giving speeches and reading books and writing articles. We got to start doing something. And so I do just want to say that I think the use of violence, even if it's justified according to the non-aggression principle, if you think you're using against people that initiate against you, it's overrated. A lot of times you can achieve much better things without using violence. And let me just give you an example. There's this guy, I think his name's James Lawson, that's he was in, the reason I know about him is because I live in Nashville, I'm not from there originally, and there was a guy there. So it was in the 1960s, and he was a reverend who was very interested in the civil rights struggle, and he wanted to lead the desegregation effort of downtown Nashville. And I don't know, I know like libertarians would be interested to know, is this, you know, were there government laws mandating segregation, or was it the businesses were doing it because they thought that's what their white customers wanted? So I don't know that, and I know that would be important for a full part of the story. But what I do know is the techniques that he used, and it was interesting. So he had all these idealistic college students, black and white, who didn't like the segregation that was the official policy of the downtown stores. And so they were going to have sit-ins, right? They were just going to go and, like, sit at the lunch counters and protest the fact that blacks weren't allowed to sit there. And so to try to, you know, bring publicity to the story and all that kind of stuff. And so this guy had training seminars. And all I'm bringing this up for is just to show that to say you're not going to use violence, there's this group of libertarians right now that thinks that's like an act of cowardice, and that means that you're not a tough guy or something if you're not willing to go kill somebody over something. But these people were actually far tougher than that, because what they would do in these training seminars would have techniques for how they would sit there and let people come up and just like punch them and spit at them and swear at them and things like that. And you know, the point was, you can't hit back, because if we hit back, then we're going to lose public opinion, because they already hate us. They think we're wrong, and we need to just be portrayed as the victims and get sympathy for our cause. And so that was the strategy. And so the training seminar was things like saying, okay, there'll be a people on the outer edge of the ring who will take, you know, the beating first. And then when you can tell, if you're on the inside and you can see that this person's had enough, it's sort of like wrestling, and you tag them and you bring them on the inside. And so then you go out and you get hit for 5 minutes and have a guy swear at you and just talk to him and try to engage him in conversation and make them think you're a human being. And just, you know, once you can't take it anymore. So, and it eventually worked, right? That strategy eventually, you know, the Nashville government changed the policy or whatever, because the mayor, you know, was a political or a public relations nightmare. So I'm just saying things like that, and obviously Gandhi, and there are other examples of using nonviolence, because ultimately it's, you know, government, and this is a Misesian point drawing on David Hume and others, that government rests on public opinion. And so if you don't like the society in which you live and you think, oh, we're living under a tyrannical government, ultimately the reason that is, it's not because there's 100 people in Washington and boy, if we could just somehow get rid of them and I don't care how we do it, then we'd be free. That's not really true. The reason they're there is because, for good or for wrong, most of our fellow citizens or people, if you don't like the word citizen, believes in this system. And so you have to change their mind. And right now, yeah, they do probably think that your views, I'm guessing most of you in here are crazy views, and you're not, you know, you're more likely to convince somebody without a gun, put it that way. So anyway, that's my little soapbox spiel about why I think nonviolent methods are more persuasive. But why don't we move on and talk about just the economics of it. So private law is hard, whereas private defense is easy. And what I mean by that is, when you're trying to explain to somebody, you know, how could what we would call a free society work, where everything is privatized, there is no state doing the things that most people think the states are supposed to do, the logical difficulty is to explain, where does a system of law come from? Because that's really the conceptual problem, that, you know, doesn't there need to be one set of rules? And if you don't have some single rulemaking authority, how could that be possible? Whereas if you have that, if you grant me that for the sake of argument, that there could be well-defined property rights and everybody would know objectively, you know, who the lawbreakers were and who the innocent victims were if there was some kind of aggression occurring, or violence occurring, I should say, because aggression is a loaded term. if you grant me that, then it's easy to just talk about, okay, how would a free market and defense evolve, and how would the, you know, those services be conducted? And that's, and why would that system be more efficient than if the government tried to monopolize it? So that's easy if you give me the legal framework. So like I said, for me, the hard part conceptually is private law. So if you want to learn more about this and my views, let me just throw out some recommended readings, because like I said, I want to go through this fairly quickly this morning with you guys. I have a pamphlet called Chaos Theory. It's, you know, down in the bookstore, some copies in the library, and all this stuff is online free also. And but let me just caution you. So I wrote Chaos Theory when I was in grad school, and it's not that I disagree with anything in there, but I think my views on private law were, I was assuming a lot of stuff from where I started that essay on private law and chaos theory. And so really what you should read first from me is, it's an essay called The Possibility of Private Law, and that's on Mises.org. So if you just do, you know, Murphy, Possibility of Private Law, it should pop up. And then another one is an essay by me on Mises.org called Wouldn't Warlords Take Over? All right, so those, and that's just a quick essay. So if you read The Possibility of Private Law, Wouldn't Warlords Take Over, and then the two essays in Chaos Theory, that would give you more of the kind of stuff I'm just giving you a flavor of in this lecture. And then in there, I have citations to, you know, the standard classic work. So by no means would you be done reading on this subject, but if you go there, then you can see the links to Rothbard and Hoppe, and David Friedman also spells out the Tannehills also have some good, you know, some insights in their work that you're not going to get in those other authors I mentioned. Okay, so let me just walk through how this might work. So somebody, let's say you're coming home and you see someone breaking into your house and runs out the back with a TV set, your TV set, and you're pretty sure it's the kid down the street. So how would that transpire? How would that unfold? And so what you need to see is that even in a free society, even if people are generally law-abiding, that there's going to be disputes, all right? So even not talking about the TV, so I'm backing up for a second. Let me give you the framework. Even not talking about something overtly criminal, but just, you know, you have a contract with your employee, and he gives you a two-week notice, and then, but it's not clear, wait a minute, you know, he just leaves and says, well, you're supposed to give me a two-week notice, but he doesn't, and so then, you know, what happens? Does there some penalty involved, or, you know, that kind of thing? Do you get to not pay him for the previous month? And so you could see where there'd be situations where, you know, and maybe the reason he needs to leave is because, you know, he's got a death in the family or something, or he's got his mom breaks her hip, and he's just got to go take care of her, and, you know, he can't stay at the job. So, I mean, there's things where somebody could have signed a contract and not really realized the position it was going to put him in down the road, and so he breaks the contract. And so you'd have situations like that where there's not malevolence or somebody's really, you know, a bad guy or something, but it's just there's contractual violations. And so there would be a role for private judges, clearly. And all, you know, at its simplest level, what is a private judge? It's somebody who renders judgment, gives an opinion on a case. And so the thing that's the mark of a voluntary society and the legal structure in that kind of a world is that both parties would agree to the particular judge who was going to give a ruling or write an opinion on the case. And so if you even think about that, even in our current status system, that's what they call it. When the judge writes something, it's called, you know, an opinion. And so that's really what judges do, is they hear evidence in a case, you know, they hear two sides to a dispute, and then they give, you know, the judge gives his or her opinion on the matter. And so it's a little bit, I guess what I'm trying to say is, because right now that opinion is backed up by the government's guns, we sometimes tend to think of, well, that's really what it is that there's these guns involved. But I'm saying at its most fundamental level, what the judge is ruling is to say who is in the right and who is in the wrong, according to me, and I'm fallible, and that's why my ruling could be overturned. And it is just an opinion. You know, it's not that the judge writes out the fact of the matter. It renders an opinion. And so I think that word is significant. That's even what we refer to it as. So again, let me just give you a little bit more of the context before talking about what if it's an overtly criminal act. A lot of people, like I say, they when you talk like that, for some reason, they think that, you know, when it comes to law, that kind of system wouldn't work. That, you know, it can't be, you know, what do you mean that the two people voluntarily submit to the same judge? That's crazy. Clearly, one person, you know, if somebody knows he's in the wrong, then why would he ever agree to go to a particular judge who's competent? Like, why wouldn't he always just insist, no, I'm only going to go to a judge who's my brother-in-law, or I'm only going to go to a judge that I know always rules a certain way? And in cases like this, and they might think that people could never come to an agreement, but that's just not true. I mean, we know it in the real world, it's not true. There's all kinds of arbitration right now where people will have a dispute, and you know, if they're getting a divorce or something like that, or if it's a business, you know, two businesses suing each other, or management and the employee are having a disagreement, and they don't want to go to the government courts because it'll just be tied up forever. And so instead, you know, in their contract, in many labor contracts right now and other sorts of agreements, there'll be clauses in there that explicitly say, should we have a dispute over this contract, we both agree to submit to binding arbitration. And what that language means, in case you don't know, is that they're saying right now in the real world, this isn't hypothetical, right now there are all kinds of arbitrators, that's their job, and they hear cases and they render an opinion, and the parties can agree to it. Now, it's true in the context of the government legal system backed up by guns, a lot of times you're kind of, by going to see the arbitrator, you're sort of agreeing beforehand that, okay, whatever this person says, you know, the government by default is going to back that up with its guns. So if one of us doesn't follow what the arbitrator says, then in a sense, we're breaking the law. But you can see the sanctions that would kick in even if it weren't for that. And also historically, if you go and read some of the stuff, like I say, the things I recommended to you, if you go and read the background literature, there were cases where like merchants would operate, you know, with other merchants in other city states or other nation states, and where there was no overarching legal framework. That, you know, if you had a dispute with someone from another country, there was no sovereign power that was above both of you, and so you couldn't, there was no court where you had standing to go take this person, and they had like just merchant courts that would sell it really quickly. And the reason you would agree with what the merchant court said was that if you didn't, then nobody would ever do business with you again, or at least nobody outside of the jurisdiction of your own sovereign, because then they would know, if this guy rips me off, then there's nothing I can do, because he's already shown he's not going to listen to what the merchant court says. All right, so that kind of framework, I think it just applies more generally, where if it became known in the community that you were the sort of person that doesn't do what the arbitrator says, then people are going to be reluctant to deal with you anymore. And so, yeah, it's true, you can come up with examples, like if somebody's an axe murderer or something, you know, that might not make him say, oh, wait a minute, if I chop this person's head off, then I'm not going to be able to rent a car next week, so I better not, right? I mean, so, but for the vast majority of people, those sorts of sanctions would matter, that if you became a pariah in the community, you couldn't rent a car, you couldn't, you know, a landlord wouldn't lease an apartment to you, you wouldn't be able to buy a house, you wouldn't be able to do, you know, all sorts of things that we take for granted that the other property owners would be able to do just to protect themselves if they didn't want to associate with you, all right? Because even like the public sidewalk, what we now think of as the public sidewalk, well, actually, they'd be private sidewalks. So there's all kinds of things that could happen to somebody who had demonstrated, I don't care what these courts say. So my point is, clearly, you would want to not flout the ruling if you had agreed to something. And so then the question is, well, why would you agree to go to a particular arbitrator? And it's the same sort of thing. So now let me walk through this example. So, like I said, you're driving home and you see somebody who looks like the kid down the street that you can't stand that kid. You've had it out for him for a while now. And he's running on the back of your house with your television set. And you get into your house and you see that the back door, you know, the back porch glass is broken, or, you know, the sliding door's open and your TV's gone. So the next day, you know, you go and you lodge a complaint and you go into the relevant judicial office and you say, yeah, that kid down the street stole my TV and I want to press charges. So what would they do? And there's all kinds of theoretical musings from various libertarian authors about the structure of this, but I'm keeping it simple. I'm focusing just on the essence of the judicial aspect, that it's probably true that there would be intermediate agencies who would represent you and that they would be the ones doing all the negotiating. But I'm just trying to get to the essence of the legal ruling itself, that what you want. So why would you do that, first of all? If you're absolutely sure that it's the kid down the street that stole your television set, why would you even bother going to some third-party judge? Why wouldn't you just call up your cousins, you know, Vinny and Michael, and then just go to his house and take your TV back, right? And the reason you wouldn't do it, I mean, but seriously, think about it. Why wouldn't you just do that? And it's because if your neighbors saw you doing that and they didn't have any contact, you know, some guy's just watering his lawn, he sees you and these two burly guys go up and open the door, and, you know, some 17-year-old kid opens, and then you just tackle him and then walk out of the house with a television set, it looks like you and your cousins are criminals. And that's not, and then you could say, oh no, see what happened was I came home late last night. And people would be like, whoa, 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 you can't just go around breaking down people's doors and tackling them and taking television sets. You know, there needs to be some sort of official due process, right? So that's why you wouldn't want to do that. You know, you'd be called a vigilante or whatever they would call you. So that's the function of you. If you think you're in the right and you're sure it's this kid that stole it, you go to the third-party judge and you lodge a complaint and say, I think this kid did it. And so then, you know, they could notify him. Again, the details on how the actual process works would vary, and it would depend. You'd need it in a competitive market to see what would make the most sense. I'm just giving you the flavor of it. So he's going to know there's this pending claim against him. And so then he, what's the, you know, presumably he's going to deny it and say, no, what are you talking about? I was at a movie last night. And so if he really were at a movie last night, you know, and he's got the stub and he was with a bunch of people and they'll testify and it's, you know, it's not like they're, you know, they're all honor roll students or something, then maybe he would just go ahead with the particular court you took it to and just testify and so forth. And maybe then, the, you know, the judge would say, well, there's not enough evidence to convict here. But like, what if you had closed circuit camera in your house? And what if the television set in his house has the serial number and you can prove that we, with the receipt, that's my television set? You see what I'm saying? So all the sorts of things about evidence that we would normally think would come to bear in a regular trial, all that stuff could matter here as well. And the thing is, there would be a competitive system of judges. And some judges would specialize in environmental cases. Some would specialize in, you know, a burglary and things like that, home invasion cases. So there would be expert judges that all they did was rule on that narrow type of case. And so this, you know, this guy could say, well, wait a minute, I don't trust the particular judge you went to, that guy's got a reputation that, you know, he's a real law and order guy, and he always finds that the, you know, defendant is guilty. And so I'm not going to agree to go and present evidence to that guy because he's biased. So if there's an open competitive market, that's fine. And if the kid has a point, if you really did take the allegation to some judge that's known to be, really anti-defendant or pro-plaintiff, then your neighbors might agree. But the point is, there would be a market, a niche for genuinely fair judges that, you know, that everybody could kind of agree, and it would just be known that, you know, that person's a straight shooter, and they're not going to be biased. You know, they might make a mistake. It's not that they're perfect, but you don't suspect them of systematic corruption. You certainly don't suspect them of, you know, taking bribes under the table or that sort of thing. And so the thing is, if this kid kept refusing, or his, you know, if his parents were speaking for him, you know, if they just kept refusing, and you said, well, okay, here's a list of 30 judges in the area, I'm willing to take my case to any of them because I've got my video surveillance. You know, I think the serial number on your television matches what I have, and your alibis don't stand up. You know, you say you were at a movie or something by yourself, and, you know, no one can verify one way or the other. So, you know, you could go through it. You think you got an airtight case, so you're willing to go to all these various judges, and if he or his parents just keep saying, no, 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 those people are all biased, eventually it's clear that they're just stalling. And then you can go and say, well, since we can't agree on a judge, you know, and if they're, you know, maybe they can recommend their alternatives and say, well, here's a list of judges we would be willing to go to. And the point is, if there's no overlap, I'm saying it would be pretty obvious which side was being fair and which wasn't. So that's, you know, so now if you think about it, like, the claim has been pushed back, someone who wants to deny that kind of system could work, the claim is a lot more nuanced now. It's not simply like, oh, well, you couldn't possibly have private judges. Like now they're back in the corner saying, well, I'm thinking in practice maybe the community wouldn't be able to agree on a set of judges that generally could be regarded as fair, that there would never be an overlap, that if genuinely fair plaintiffs had a list of people they were willing to take their case to, and then the defense team had a list of judges they were willing to take their case to, and there was no overlap, that seems, you know, do you think that would be plausible or not, that wouldn't happen in a free society? And also, too, I'm not even mentioning there'd be lawyers. You know, if it's a serious case and it's, you know, there's a lot of money at stake, or if it's a criminal case, then, you know, there's lawyers involved, and that brings another level of professionalism to it where that's what their job is. So, you know, the plaintiff's lawyer and the defense lawyer presumably, like, interact with each other a lot, representing other people in different cases. And so it's just, in my mind, again, I think in the vast majority of cases it would be straightforward where both sides could agree on a particular judge to say this is the person who will hear our case and we both think we have a shot at winning it. Now, again, if one, you know, the lawyer might look at the evidence and just say to the kid, no, you might not be guilty, and that's a shame if you're really not, but, you know, I'm sorry, but they got a slam dunk case here, and so I recommend you just, you know, settle and da-da-da-da-da. But the point is they're going to be able to go to a judge or find a mutually agreed upon judge, and if they don't, it's, I think, because it's going to be clear to the community that one of them is just stalling, in which case one side goes to some reputable judge and they try the kid without him being there, and then that judge, you know, renders a ruling. And so it's, so in my mind, there would be a distinction between judicial rulings and then the police power of enforcement. So it's a separate, you know, so the judges per se don't have people with guns backing up what they do. They just render the opinion, give the what they think the verdict is. So you take it to the judge and he or she looks at the evidence and says, oh, yeah, I think you're right. I think that kid did steal your television set. And so that means they owe you, you know, the financial equivalent of the television set plus X amount in damages or whatever, you know, whatever the ruling is. And that could just be, you know, hanging over the kid's head. And then, like I say, maybe the way that actually gets enforced, if it's just something like a financial penalty, is that nobody does business with that kid until he takes care of that. You know, that fact could be kept in some registration system, just like, you know, your driving record, you know, how many tickets you've gotten in various places. If somebody, you know, before you can get auto insurance, they could check that and see. Or if you, when you apply for health insurance, your medical history could be somewhere. So it's not that there's some central agency that collects all that information and is in control of your life. It's just there's distributed, decentralized things, that organizations that keep track of different parts of your history, and then the relevant people can check that before they do something that, you know, to them it would matter. They would want to know before someone gives you an auto insurance policy. They would want to know, did you get pulled over 8 times last year? And again, there would be, you know, we're talking about private maintenance of private roads and so forth. It's not a police force. So that's the way I think that just a private system would work. So again, the particular ruling, this is Hans Hoppe's. So these slides were funnier when these guys were still teaching here. This is Hans Hoppe. So, you know, he would be rendering the judgment. And then once it's out there, and again, if it's something serious, like the kid stole the television set and he's not paying up, you know, at that point, then it's possible, then you go to this third party agency that's just real, you know, burly guys, and they have body armor on and stuff like that. And then they come in and come get your television set. And again, this is another Mises U faculty member who's not here with us. So, and just, again, think through the logic of that, that all the stuff we associate right now, the problems of police, like, you know, police brutality, and they do all sorts of stuff to you, but, you know, when they grab you and interrogate you and things like that, routinely lie to you. I mean, what's funny is, you know, all these cop shows, I mean, I stopped watching television a while ago, but, you know, growing up, there was, you know, NYPD Blue was a big one that I used to watch with my parents. And, I mean, the cops, even the good cops, routinely lied to innocent people. you know, like people would see the mob do something, they'd be afraid to testify because they would say, well, no, I don't want to get involved. And the cops would just lie to them and say, no, you just tell us what you know. We're not going to put you on the stand. And so then the person would tell, and then they would end up putting the guy in the stand, and the, you know, the mafia would know this guy's testifying against us. And it was like, and there was even an episode where, you know, some newcomer, like some young DA, district attorney, you know, she was hesitant to do that. Like, she didn't want to lie to the innocent person and have that person risk his life by testifying against the mob boss. And the other older veteran cops were, like, making fun of her. Like, what, you're worried about lying to an innocent person and making him jeopardize his life? No, we got a job to do. And like I said, to me, it was just shocking. And these were, like, the heroes of the show. You know what I mean? And so it was just amazing. I mean, cops routinely lie to people. And I don't just get my information from television. I've actually, you see police, you know, former police or whatever, just explaining how they do their job. And, yeah, they get you into the interrogation room, and it's just clear. They will say whatever they need to get you to say what they want you to say. So that sort of thing would not, you know, and whenever, in, at least in the United States, maybe it's like this around the world too, but whenever you have some outrageous example of police brutality that, you know, they're taking some woman into custody and she's swearing at them and they just, you know, smash her head into the squad car, so, you know, something completely out of line, unnecessary. And, you know, whenever anyone objects to that, you will get a chorus of people saying, oh, well, then don't call them the next time someone's breaking into your house. You know, or, oh, I guess, you know, you don't like the police. You know, you don't want to have any police. You just want there to be chaos. And, you know, and that's, it'd be weird. It'd be like, you know, if you, every time you went to get gas in your car, if the owner came out and took a baseball bat and broke your window, you'd be, you know, you could complain about that, and people would say, oh, so you don't want to drive anymore? You just don't want people, you see what I'm saying? And it's just weird that that's where it is. Like, it's an all or nothing that the police, you know, if they can be able to do whatever they want, and or, you know, just have no law enforcement whatsoever, and that's the standard defense and the way these things go in the public opinion or debates. So if you had competitively supplied law enforcement, again, where it was distributed, where it was not one entity that both determined who was a lawbreaker and then sent one, you know, squad of guys with guns or whatever after them. If there were competing agencies, well, then if one of them did do things that were out of line, well, then they would go out of business. And not even just because, how can I put it? So let me just walk through this one. So let's say that, you know, Guido's TV retrieval service, you know, they go up to the thing and they knock on the door and a 17-year-old kid opens the door and they grab him and, you know, they start pounding him and saying, you know, don't you understand about the non-aggression principle? And they're, you know, pounding him. He said, what's wrong with you stealing property? He mixed his labor at that television. You know. And you could say, so even if technically the way the law worked, that was admissible, that was okay, you know, that, in other words, that they weren't guilty because you say, well, no. You know, that kid stole the television set, and so you're allowed to go retrieve it and to use force if you need to, and you had a wide latitude on what it means to need to use force. The point is, they would go out of business because the neighbors around there would be, what are you doing? And, you know, and the person who's, you know, the person who hired them to do that would be a bit squeamish and, you know, would say, oh, I didn't know that they were going to do that. So the point is, competitive agencies would then, you know, point to that and say to the community, next time, you know, if someone steals your television set and then you have a ruling from a reputable judge saying that, yes, it's yours and you want someone to come get it for you, come to us. You know, we don't beat the heck out of the people the way, you know, Guido's retrieval service does. And so come to us. So this one is they would go out of business whether or not his employees actually went to prison or something or were legally prosecuted. The point is they would quickly fade away. And that, again, just going back to what I said up front, that's why monopolies are bad. Because when you have a monopoly of something, if they're doing something wrong, but yet it's a vital service, you might have to just tolerate it, right? If there's a monopoly of water supply and the person routinely swears at you or whatever, well, it's not like you're going to give up water. But if there's a competitive supply and you can get drinking water from various cellars, well, then if some guy is being rude to you all the time, he would just go out of business overnight. So, I mean, this is real obvious stuff, but yet for some reason people don't apply that logic when it comes to a legal system. Okay, so question, would there be prisons in a free society?
So the way I view it is there would be something, there could be something like prisons, and here's how it would unfold the way I'm thinking of it, is that what you would want is groups who would vouch for you, all right? So just let's use an analogy for a minute. Right now in the real world, if you want to drive, you have to have auto insurance, or you're supposed to. I mean, people drive without insurance, but they're not supposed to. And I think there might be something analogous to that in a totally free society where the roads are privately owned, that the owner might say, as a condition of you coming onto my road with your vehicle, you have to have auto insurance. Because if you, you know, get in an accident, hit somebody, and cause $1 million in damage, you know, you need to pay for that. So you need to have an insurance company because you don't presumably don't have $1 million just sitting in your checking account to pay the person. And maybe there would be like one-shot provisions of auto insurance that, like, when you get on, you pay a $5 fee, and maybe, you know, you're buying an auto insurance policy for that week or something. But the point is, I think there would be something analogous to the requirement of having auto insurance to drive, at least on major roads. And right now in today's world, and also I think would happen in a genuinely free society, like brain surgeons, heart surgeons, they have to have medical malpractice insurance. So what is that? You have an insurance policy that says, I'm a brain surgeon. If I screw up and, you know, kill the patient and it's proven that it was a tough case and nobody could have done, but no, if I genuinely do something wrong, if I make a mistake during the operation and kill you when you should not have died from that operation, you can sue me, and because the judgment might be such a large, or not you could sue me, your next of kin could sue me, and because you know, that judgment might be such a big number that, again, I need to have insurance because I might not be able to pay that out of pocket. And so, you know, the mechanism, it would probably be like a hospital where these operations, these surgeries are taking place, or some sort of clinic that specializes in brain surgery or whatever. That would just be a standing rule so that people would know, oh, if you go to this real reputable place for your, you know, to have your tumor dealt with, then they have just standard in this market that, yeah, there's, of course, there's insurance in case something were to happen, God forbid, they can pay your family $1 million or whatever it is. And so that would just be a requirement that if you're a doctor and want to work at this reputable clinic where we provide top-notch service, that you have to have insurance. Okay, so that this concept of having insurance, not in case something happens to you, but in case you do something to somebody else, is not just theoretical. It's we have it in the real world right now. That all of you guys have it if you have auto insurance, and you know doctors right now have it with medical malpractice insurance. So I'm thinking there could be, it might make sense in a free society to have something analogous, just more generally, that people might have policies that say, you know, if I'm found guilty of murder, and the judge says that I owe the next of kin $1 million, well then you know I have this insurance policy that actually pays the person. And then, you know, all the other ramifications happen to me. But the idea is, instead of me just owing them $1 million and having to work it off over 50 years or whatever it is, that they get paid instantly. And then maybe, you know, I have some deal with the insurance company, like to keep my premiums lower. Maybe there's an agreement that I pay them over time or whatever it may be. But the idea is you have third parties vouching for you. And given your history, the premiums you pay are the membership fees to be part of this association or whatever the terminology is would vary so that, you know, somebody who goes out and gets in bar fights every week is going to have to pay more to have a third party vouch for them because that person's more violent, more likely to go out and do something reckless, right? So that's the framework. So now in that context, if you see where I'm going with that, and that you would need to be part of some sort of larger association. And again, why would you do that? Well, because you might need to in order to be allowed to work at a major corporation. They might just have as a standing rule, well, no, if you're going to work here, you got to, you know, have one of these outside agencies, reputable agencies, vouching for you or to rent a car, things like that. So what if then you were convicted of something, you know, you're a serial killer or something like that, you know, again, where nobody's going to vouch for you. It's not like they're going to just charge you a high premium. That no, if you're a serial killer, you know that's the premium they would have to charge you would be too high. You wouldn't be able to afford it. So what would happen to those people, and again, remember, everything is privately owned. Every square inch of land, somebody or some group of people owns, so nobody's going to want a convicted serial killer on their property. They're saying, get out of here. So, you know, the person could be pushed into the ocean, and then even the private ocean owners would say, no, swim over there. Get out of my, this is my volume of ocean. Or what I was saying is there could be the analog of prisons. What it would be is just an area, a secure area where, you know, somebody could build this thing and they could say to these pariahs, these outlaws, say, hey, nobody else is going to let you even stand on their property and you're going to die pretty soon. So why don't you come here? We've reviewed your case. We understand your background and we have trained staff that work here. And when you come in, we're going to strip search you and make sure you don't have any weapons on you. And then there's a very restricted daily lifestyle you have here. And, you know, when you eat lunch, we're not going to give you a steak knife, that's for sure. And, you know, they're going to do some, but, you know, you're going to have a nice little area. It's not going to feel like a cell. It's going to be like a little living area. You're going to have an internet connection because we understand you're a brilliant engineer. It's just you have this weird thing where you kill prostitutes. You know, go figure. So, you know, hey, I got a gambling habit. What? You know, I'm not judging anybody. So we're going to keep you in the security, and you can't leave, though. That's the thing. So when, you know, you come in here, and you're going to sign a contract and everything, and you're going to stay here, and you can do your engineering work and so forth. You can talk to other people, and, you know, you're not going to get bullied or harassed by the other people. They wouldn't even call them inmates. I don't know what they would call them, team members, who knows what, visitors, campers. I don't know what they would call them. And, you know, and so it would be a very pleasant sort of therapeutic thing, and they'd probably make them go see counselors or, you know, whatever it is. But the point is they would have neutralized them, that they are not going to pose a threat to the community, and this thing would be designed, you know, with that sort of person in mind. And so, like I said, the difference, you know, it would be like a hotel, except you wouldn't be able to get out, right? So, and I made it just like the Hotel California, right? So, but just think through the logic of that. These things would be competing with each other. Right, I don't know what they would call them. They might not even call them prisons, but they would be competing for convicts. That the convicts would come and patronize them. And so, if one of them had a reputation that the guards there were real sadistic and would do demeaning things to you or literally beat you up or something, well, then nobody would go there. There'd be a competitor, you know, a competing place like this that would say, no, come here. Yeah, you're not. Once you come in, you're not going to be able to get out. Your freedom's restricted, but that's your own fault. I mean, that's because no one in this community is letting you stay on their property because you're an axe murderer. So come here, and yeah, you can't leave. But you know what? No one. Once you come in here, you're safe. You're physically safe. That there's no abuse here. Our guards are well trained. Blah blah blah. Right. So that's and also if you don't have to fear getting abused by the fellow campers at this place. Right, because that's, you know, what happens in prison in today's world. It's not just that the guards are messed up, but it's also things happen with the other inmates. And incidentally, these people make jokes about it and stuff, but I mean that's really a rampant problem. And I've heard stories from people in terms of the guards that this one guy told me. He said that he was a younger guy and he was in some like drug charge or something like that. And so he was in there, and he was just saying, like, the way the guards would mess with them. And he would say that, you know, they were real nice, like, when the parents would visit because, you know, they didn't want, you know, the parents to complain or anything. But he said once the parents were gone, like, the guards were just, he said the one guy, you know, he was told to sweep the floor. You know, so this guy's going around with a broom sweeping the floor. And the guard said, wait a minute, you missed a spot right there. There's sunlight right there. Right? You get it, like, that the sun was hitting the floor, and the guard was telling him, sweep the sunlight up. Which you can't do. I don't know if you guys are getting this. I'm saying he was just telling stories about how these guards would just mess with them. And, you know, and they were younger. You know, I don't know if it was a juvenile detention or what. I'm kind of forgetting the details. But my point is just, you know, that's not, how can I put it? A lot of times libertarians are coming from, like, right-wing conservative sides, and they just sort of, like, get more radical and get, you know, the logic of free enterprise applied to a more broader. And so then if you see people complaining about police brutality and things like that, since it's typically coming from like Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson, sometimes there's a tendency to say, oh, no, they're just making all that stuff up and, you know, those crazy liberals and they want bigger government. I don't believe any of that. And I'm just saying that
No, there are a lot of just horrible things that police do right now, and that once you get into the prison system, it's just obnoxious and horrible and completely arbitrary, and that kind of stuff would not happen if there were competition in that framework. Okay, let's talk a little bit about military defense. We go to 11:15, right? Okay, all right, so I'll speed it up here. So, like I said, I spent most of the time on the private law stuff. Let me just say a few more words on that. The idea that people think that, okay, no, there couldn't be this objective body of law that the experts agreed on. I think it's all subjective, and that just because there's competing interests, and, you know, wouldn't this judge over here say, no, the way I read property rights, you know, these people own everything. And then wouldn't people over here say, no, these people over here own everything, and wouldn't it just be this big disagreement because it's all subjective and it's all just special interests vying for power? But you don't see that in other areas, too. Like, if you say, who determines the rules of grammar? Something like that. You just walk through the implications of that, and you say, well, there's grammar books. And you say, okay, but is it the people who publish the grammar books, are they really determining what the rules are? And it's not really, it's more that they're codifying the rules. The rules kind of just are out there. But it's also not that there's this objective, unchanging set of rules of grammar, right? If, in terms of the English language, if you go read Shakespeare, they speak differently from how we speak today, right? The things that were proper usage back then are not today. Things have evolved. And so there's a sense in which the community and all of us together determine what the rules of grammar are, and there's a sense in which it's subjective, that it's not just some, you know, distinct, pristine thing that human action has nothing to do with, because, no, by our actions in speaking and writing, we do change what the rules are of grammar. But yet there's also a sense in which right now, if somebody says ain't in a high school essay, the teacher can quite clearly say, no, that's wrong, and not, you know, fear someone's saying, well, how do you know it's wrong? Can't we say, you know, the rules have changed? No, it's wrong right now. You know what I'm saying? So by the same token, and there's gray areas too, right? There's things, you know, where some grammarians would say, no, the rules should be one way, and others would say, you know, I don't think it needs to be like that. And they could argue over some subtle little point, but there's clear-cut things where everybody agrees, no, that's ungrammatical. And so that's what I think the law would be like. So yeah, there could be real fine, subtle areas, or like a real tough case where even the experts would disagree and say, no, I think the plaintiff was right in this one. And other people say, no, I don't think I would have thrown that out if it came before my court, you know, that kind of thing. But there's other cases too where, you know, someone's a serial killer and they're going to say, yeah, that guy's guilty of murder, right? And that's, everyone's going to agree. So that's what I think the law would be like. And then when you say, well, who's in charge of the law? There's a sense in which it would be the judges with their rulings and the collected wisdom of all their rulings and the precedent would be determining the law, and it would change over time. But there's also a sense in which, you know, there's no one person or group in command of it, the way right now that the legislatures at least fancy that they're the ones setting the law. And this goes to Hayek's famous distinction between law and legislation. Incidentally, because I got to move on now because we're running out of time, but if you don't even know, if you've never heard of that, you should go Google that. Just, you know, Hayek, law versus legislation. And I think Don Boudreau has a quick post on his website about that, just that you know, law is something that governs human actions, and it's something the community recognizes, whereas legislation is, you know, people thinking we're going to set out and consciously write down what the rules are, and those are two different things. And so Hayek's point was, historically, people were governed by law well before they had the hubris to think they could write legislation. So, you know, if law just means rules that societies obey, clearly in order for there to be what we think of as civilization, people had to be following laws. But Hayek is saying that came first, that people just obeyed certain principles and there were taboos and things that you just knew, you know, like you don't engage in cannibalism, you know, you don't marry your daughter, you know, stuff like that, that they might not have known why that was a bad thing to do, but they had to, because Hayek made like an evolutionary argument, saying if there were two tribes and one tribe practiced cannibalism and one didn't, 200 years later, which one do you think is going to be more prosperous, right? So that kind of argument. So for whatever reason, he's saying people are rule-following animals,
creatures. And then it was only later, after seeing law, you know, law existing and governing, that the rulers then thought, well, you know, why can't we just change this and do it to our advantage? Okay, military defense. This is the more fun stuff. So I think it would largely be funded by insurance companies if we're in the context of a major, you know, modern industrial power like the United States or Canada, European nations. I think that insurance companies would do a lot of what we now think of as government funding of the military. I don't think there would be huge standing armies, right? And especially if the agency were run by somebody named Guido Hulsman, you would not want that kind of symbol atop your banner. It'd just be bad for PR. So, why wouldn't there be large standing armies? Well, just because that would be inefficient, right? That'd be wasteful. You don't need armies like that. Let me just go off on a little tangent again. I haven't seen it in a while. Lately, now it's been superhero movies where there's just a few individuals with amazing powers, and so that's great. But like about, I don't know, 5 years ago, well, 10 years ago, it was big where they had all these movies, these big blockbuster movies that came out that always would end with a climatic battle scene where there's thousands of people on one side running against thousands of people, like, oh, and they all just start hacking each other. And as I'm watching that, you know, everyone's cringing because it's violent, and I'm just like, this is so inefficient. Like, you know, look at the opportunity cost. All this labor could have been making all these widgets, and instead they're just killing each other. This is horrifying, you know. The production possibilities frontier is shrinking as I watch this thing. So seriously, I mean, so if you just think about, like, you know, the innovations in the standard thing we do is, like, with agriculture, right? And you say that over, you know, 1900, what percentage of the labor force was in agriculture? It was a big number. I don't know off the top of my head. And that shrank over time. The same thing like with manufacturing. People freak out about, oh, we're losing our manufacturing base. And usually what it means is the percentage of the labor force in manufacturing is going down, but the absolute output of manufactured goods is typically much higher. Maybe not as a percentage of GDP, but fewer and fewer people are able to make more and more stuff in the factories. And so that's a sign of innovation and improvement, that you're freeing up labor to go do something else. So I think it's the same thing here, that a free society, I don't think it would need a standing army of millions of people. That would be crazy, that they could get the job done. They would just pick a much more elite, finely trained group that were, you know, using bombers and helicopters and spy satellites and submarines and, you know, tactical missiles and so forth, and they would be able to repel a much bigger army, especially one that was just drafted, and a bunch of people who were, you know, grabbed against their will and given a gun and 2 weeks of training and said, now go kill those people. Those people wouldn't stand a chance against the professional core in a privately funded enterprise. So as far as the insurance companies, how would that work? So you're in a big city. There's lots of big skyscrapers. You could have insurance for natural disasters. Like if there's a fire, you pay an insurance company. So if there is a fire, they indemnify you. And so the insurance company is probably going to take measures like, say, you need to have smoke alarms, you need to have sprinkler systems, stuff like that, because they're on the hook if that fire occurs. And so I want to say, if there were no government navies and air force and armies, right now you're kind of a sitting duck to foreign invasion if you've got all kinds of expensive skyscrapers. And so I think there an insurance company could come along and say, we will indemnify you if you get taken, if your property gets damaged or seized by some foreign power. And so you pay premiums, and then what are they going to do? They're not just going to sit back and cross their fingers and hope nothing happens. They can change the likelihood of you being invaded. And so the insurance company would take those premium payments and then go hire infantry and surface-to-air missiles and what have you. Okay, some common objections. Wouldn't the mafia become the government? I'm going to whip through these really fast. This actually, it's the exact opposite. The mafia right now derives its strength from the government. If you think about what areas is the mafia strong in, it's things that are either outright illegal or heavily regulated. So, you know, gambling, prostitution, alcohol during prohibition, right now illegal narcotics, loan sharking, which means charging a rate of interest that's well above the legally permissible rate. So that's not a coincidence. The mafia goes into those areas where it's illegal for reputable business people to enter. And so, think about this. When they legalized alcohol, the mob got out of alcohol. And so if what
anarcho-capitalism is that everything is legalized, even the provision of law and military defense, then there would be no sector for the mafia to be left in. That as you legalize more and more stuff, the mafia would go up to the remaining illegal stuff, and then once you legalized everything, they wouldn't be able to stay in business. It's not that the people in the mafia would disappear. It's that I think under the new incentive structure, they would realize using muscle and, you know, reneging on contracts and stuff like that is no longer profitable, and they would just become legitimate business people, and they would, you know, they might still be the leaders in the field, or they might not. I'm guessing they probably wouldn't, because the reason they're the head of the mafia is they have an advantage in, you know, intimidation and bribing police officers and that kind of stuff. And so that wouldn't give them an edge in a free market. Wouldn't warlords take over? Let me just skip this one, because I have a whole essay on that, and I want to leave time for your questions. Wouldn't a neighboring state invade? I don't think so. And this is a porcupine, so the idea is, you know, it's like, think of it right now. The United States hasn't attacked North Korea. This was kind of funny. Back when they invaded Iraq because they said there were weapons of mass destruction, and it turned out, oops, you know, there wasn't. North Korea, meanwhile, is telling the world, hey, we got nuclear weapons. We just tested it. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? And they're like, well, we're going to pay you some money. And that's what they did. You know, like, we're going to give you money if you promise to slow down your development. We'll give you some taxpayer dollars. And so why is that? I mean, there's various reasons, but I think part of it is when, you know, a state, you know, if you think about it, if you were a dictator, job number one would be to get at least one nuclear weapon, because otherwise you can't keep the United States from invading your country. But you know, if you have at least one and they come in, you're going to cause serious casualties, and the American public doesn't like that. So would a neighboring state invade an anarcho-capitalist society? I don't think so, for two reasons. One is they would be pretty heavily armed. Again, if it's the, you know, the people in today's world that become anarcho-capitalist, they'd be pretty heavily armed, and so it would be very costly to invade them. And then also, they don't pose a threat to the state, to the neighboring state, right? So there's no reason to. They would be trading with them. They would be, you know, they wouldn't be a threat at all. The only threat they would pose is that by their example, that the people in the state might look at them and say, wait a minute, they, you know, they have freedom. They don't have homeless people on the street the way we do. You know, they have better medical care than we do, and blah, blah, blah. And why, you know, they don't have police brutality, so why don't we live like them? That would be the only reason they'd be a threat, but they wouldn't be a direct military threat. Okay, so let me turn to your questions now. Yep. Yeah, okay, so the question is, isn't there a difference, or isn't my analogy bad, between car insurance, where it's you're insuring your own property where you don't want to hurt that, versus, like, insurance for if I go commit a crime because that's somebody else? No, I don't think so, because, I mean, you're right, you do have car insurance that protects your car, but you also have, what's it called, liability or something. Like, so if I right now go out and hit somebody, my insurance policy will pay them. And that's why people get mad. If somebody hits you and the person's uninsured, you get mad because now it's like, oh, well, now my insurance company has to pay for it because they don't have one. So right now, standard auto insurance policies do both. They'll cover your own car, but if you are at fault and hurt somebody else's car, your insurance kicks in and pays to fix their...
But
yep.
I mean, there's a chance with coming along with to get away without being charged. Can get away with a crime, so nobody's watching you and whatever. So if you have insurance before and you don't need it, for me it's a totally different thing. You know what?
Oh, well, I mean, it is different, unless we're talking about killing somebody with a car. But yeah, so I agree, it's different. I mean, yeah, it's an analogy, so it's similar in some respects and different in other respects. But I'm saying there is a precedent right now for you having insurance to make others whole for your misbehavior.
Yeah.
Purple shirt.
Do you have any thoughts about publicity trials like Zimmerman and PC Anthony, how those might be handled in a free society?
Okay, so the question is, what about, you know, real famous publicity trials, how would those be handled? The way the judges work in a free society is they need people to come to them. And there's competitors, and there's all sorts of judges who have similar expertise in that sort of case. So if somebody did turn his courtroom into a circus, you know, and had all kinds of things, I mean, his career would probably be ruined from that. So it could happen where somebody might do it to then go have a book deal and then be the, you know, to say my time is judging this famous case. But I, you know, so with all this stuff, it's not that we can guarantee this bad thing we don't like will never happen in the kind of society I'm picturing, but I think the incentives would be much stronger to minimize that sort of stuff, because a lot of people who were involved with, you know, a celebrity case like that, you know, if it really were a circus, then their reputations would be ruined and nobody would come to them in the future because they would say, well, I don't want to go before a judge that I know is willing to damage the case and the integrity of the trial, you know, to put on a show. Why don't we do one more?
Yep.
Okay, yeah, so...
But I mean, basically, like, it's not obviously that it's untenable, just that it seems like there probably would be a war. One would be an anarcho-capitalist would probably win, especially if they gave it a critical mass.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, so the question is, wouldn't neighboring states want to invade the anarcho-capitalist region because they would be losing population to them? So for sure, I agree with you that people would be sneaking into, you know, the anarcho-capitalist place because the productivity of labor would be so much higher. And, you know, everybody would want to go live there. So that is true. And I guess that just feeds back to my point that eventually, yeah, the states might say, we got to take these people out because this is just, I think it would be an embarrassment to them to have this example of people flourishing without a parasitical class, you know, that would just, you know, that the states are saying, you need us, otherwise it'll be chaos. So, I mean, at some point there might be, but again, like in World War II, you know, the Nazis didn't invade everybody, you know, and like the Swiss and other places. So it's, again, even tyrannical regimes, they're not stupid that they realize certain areas, we're just not going to mess with them and we're going to pick our battles elsewhere. So I think they would be able to get by for a while. And by the time the states realize these people are really embarrassing, we got to take care of them, hopefully it would be too late, that they would be so populated and so well armed defensively that, you know, the states wouldn't bother trying to do that. Okay, stop there. Thanks, guys.